Banks has created some complicated characters in his new novel, Lost Memory of Skin. The Kid is a lonely young man who is addicted to pornography and meets a young teenage girl online. He's arrested when he goes to her house to have sex. He ends up living with a group of sex offenders who have been released from prison and are living together under a causeway. By law, they can't be within 2,500 feet of a child. The professor, a hulking, obese sociologist with a mysterious past, befriends the kid and uses him for the research he is conducting on convicted sex offenders. Banks was inspired by a real colony of offenders that created a makeshift encampment under the Julia Tuttle Causeway in Miami. Russell Banks is the award-winning author of now 19 books, including 12 novels. Two, Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, were made into movies, with several more in the works. It's been a couple of years. And Russell Banks, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. This story really was inspired by a real colony of sex offenders that you could see from your, apartment in Miami?
Right. I live in the winter months in Miami Beach and on the bayside, and can look out over Biscayne Bay and onto the mainland. There's a causeway, the Julia Tuttle Causeway, which connects the mainland to the islands, the barrier isles that make up Miami Beach. And I could look out and see this causeway very easily. And about 4 years ago, articles started appearing in the Miami Herald and elsewhere about this this encampment. And it just I can't say it inspired me, as it fired my imagination in a way, because I began to think about what it must be like for those men down there. But in particular, thinking it, my thinking was generated by the fact that there was a mix of men there. They were all convicted sex offenders, but some of them were sociopathic serial rapists. Others were some poor old drunk who got busted for indecent exposure because he was urinating in a parking lot at 3 in the morning or something. And another one might be a guy in his early 20s who had had sex with his high school girlfriend who was under 18, which is statutory rape, so he had become a sex offender. And they were all thrown together. Mm. And the unintended consequences of good intentions, you know, as a result of that 2,500-foot barrier, had made it impossible for these men to live anywhere.
Because anywhere would have taken them closer
exactly.
than this 2,500
exactly.
feet.
Yeah.
Were you in any way nervous about talking to these men or going into this encampment? Did it feel like a scary place to you at all?
No, it felt like a squalid place, and a place that it's very difficult to imagine anyone living in. But no, I wasn't personally frightened at all. But I'm not an investigative journalist, so I wasn't interviewing people at length and that sort of thing. I'm a novelist, and I wanted to write a novel about this material because it started to exfoliate. It just got bigger and bigger and more intriguing to me and mysterious to me. I mean, every aspect of it, from the internet, the digitalization of our erotic lives, to what was often common, the addiction to pornography, the eroticizing of children in our culture. All these things were starting to kind of merge and come together. And I began to approach it from the point of view of, can I make a novel out of this? Is there a story here? Are there characters here that will engage my sympathies sufficiently? I live with them for 3 years or so in my study. And so when I went over there, I was really looking for, I was trying to answer questions like, what does it smell like? What is it? What's it?
And what does it smell like?
It smells like a garbage dump. Well, you can imagine. I mean,
yes.
It smells like a midden heap. That's maybe a better connection to an ancient midden heap. You know, what's the sound like of the rumble of vehicles 24 hours a day overhead? What's the light like? I mean, it's dark and damp down there. The tide rises and the water laps up close to where their little shanties and tents and so forth are pitched. So that was the kind of details I was looking for. Not so much, I wasn't trying to build, an academic or a journalistic account of this. It was really I wanted the materials to make a story out of it.
But what did they think of you? I mean, here's this, and I should say there's a sociologist that comes in to also understand this encampment. What did they think of you prowling
Actually, I think that they were almost too eager to tell their stories. You know, in some cases, they were self-justifying stories, and a whine along, you know, rumbling whine about how they ended up here. Other cases, they just simply wanted to be known. They wanted the fact of their existence known, and I looked like I might be an agent for that. But no, there wasn't any sense of invasion or anything like that. In fact, I think that these men were eager, most of them, the ones who were coherent enough to talk to me, were eager to be known, to have their reality, their social, their human reality known. And I think they mistook me for a journalist, you know, but so I didn't oftentimes use everything that they told me.
Several reviewers have said, and it's clear when you read this, which is you're writing about a group of sex offenders. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there are people in this country that are pariahs, mm-hmm. even in prison, mm-hmm. I mean, sex offenders have to watch their back when they're in prison mm-hmm. because they will be targets.
Exactly.
I mean, these are the sort of, you know, emotional lepers mm-hmm. of our society.
Right, and it's a taboo subject by and large. But one of the things that really engaged me was while we make distinctions in terms of the punishment and the crime and first, second, and third degree sex offense, once they're released, that was what I was interested in. What do we do now after they've served their time? Anywhere from 3 months, like the central character here, the kid serves, for a minor offense to 5 to 7 years or more sometimes for a major crime. They're all lumped together then, and they become a category of human being, one that we really don't want to reintegrate into society in any way or consider rehabilitated in any way. And I think that novels tend to try to make those distinctions and refine them down to the mm-hmm. individual case as much as possible and fly in the face of the impulse for it's a very human impulse to categorize mm-hmm. other human beings.
Right, especially if they're considered dangerous or deviant or somehow threatening.
Yeah, and if our view toward them as a group is driven by some more generalized panic, too, I mean, a kind of fear that we're not protecting our children sufficiently, or a fear of sex, or a confusion and bewilderment about the changing delivery system, as it were, of sexual information and stimulus, which is all going on right now to an enormous degree.
And I want to talk about all of that, but I'd love to have you just read a section from your novel, and this is, I guess, where we meet the kid. It's early in the novel, and I'd love to have you read that.
Okay.
Where it says, yeah, start
right,
to finish.
I got it.
Okay.
Most of the people he knew when he was a boy and in high school know the kid by his real name, and the guys he went through basic training with, and his mother, of course, and some of her friends, they know it. But he hasn't spoken to any of them, not even his mother, in over a year. And whenever he accidentally on the street spots someone he once knew slightly from school or from hanging out at the mall in the old days, or his job at the light store before he enlisted in the army, which happens every now and then, even though he never visits his old neighborhood anymore, he stares straight ahead and keeps pedaling, or if on foot, cuts across the street, or just turns on his heels and walks the other way. No one he knew before wants to meet up with him anyhow, so when they recognize him, they do the same thing, turn around and walk the other way, or check out the shoes in a Payless window, or if there's no other way to avoid eye contact, cover their face with a cap brim or sunglasses, or even with their hands. In that sense, things aren't much different now than they've always been. The way he sees it, people have been avoiding him all his life, except for the people he's become acquainted with in the past year. Not counting those who work for the state and have read his file as part of their job, the men under the causeway are in a sense the kid's new and true friends and know nothing whatsoever about his private or public past and therefore do not noticeably avoid him and are okay with calling him kid. It's superficial, but it's what he's always preferred and maybe needs, strictly enforced surface relations with people. and with his buzz cut and thin pointed nose and nub of a chin, and his big ears, and being short and skinny as a jockey, although pretty muscular, if he says so himself, it's what he looks like anyhow, a kid.
That's Russell Banks reading from his novel Lost Memory of Skin. I mean, he is the loneliest, aloneness, young. He's not a kid. He's a young man.
Yeah.
He's in his early
22,
20s.
Yeah, at the time.
But
we
one
made
senses, and his mother sort of ignored him. I mean, he was a neglected child. I don't think he was abused, but he certainly was neglected.
Right. At one point, the novel calls him a feral child. He's essentially raised himself, he's a single parent whose mother works all day and then tends to go out all night and so on. And but she feels as though she's having provided him with food and shelter. She's done plenty and feels proud of herself for that. But he has essentially raised himself. And from about the age of 11 or 12 on, he sort of loses himself into the internet and becomes addicted to the internet, and from that addicted to pornography. And that's his... That only further alienates him and leaves him even further alone as he grows through adolescence. He's like an awful lot of kids, sort of lost in that gray zone between fantasy and reality, not in either one, and not able to tell the difference, really, between fantasy or reality.
And he is, convicted of going to a young girl's house, a teenage girl's house, for sex. But as you write, this is a young man who has never even kissed a girl.
Right.
He's
right.
Never had sex.
Oh, the paradox is, yeah, he's a convicted sex offender who's a virgin. And he's never had real erotic contact with any other human being. That's part of, his problem, I guess you could say. But in the beginning, we find him as alienated as we're both describing here, and the kind of the quest of the novel is to connect him and to bring him to a point where he gets some sense of his own fate and his own possibility of his own destiny too, control over his own destiny as well. So it's a story of self-discovery in a real way, or it's meant to be, at least.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but it should be also said that the girl that he was planning on having sex with was, what, 14 years old?
Yeah.
I mean, she's he's an adult. She's
right.
A child.
Oh, yeah. And he knows what he's doing when he's doing it. And from the beginning of the story, he feels both guilt and shame, and he doesn't make much distinction between the two. He is certainly guilty. He broke the law, and the law won. But he's also feeling shame because he's essentially internalized society's view of him. And in many ways, the story is an attempt to get him to the point where he can distinguish between the two and accept his guilt and his punishment that goes with it, regardless of whether it's appropriate, and overcome his shame.
And that's Russell Banks, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new novel, and it's called Lost Memory of Skin, and it is about a young man called The Kid, also a professor called The Professor. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And as you can probably tell, probably not appropriate for young children to be listening in. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. 1812 Productions presents Mistakes Were Made, the newest comedy from Craig Wright, writer for Six Feet Under and United States of Terra. Starring Barrymore Award winner Scott Greer, this fast-paced comedy shows us an afternoon in the life of a Broadway producer who turns the theater world on its ear when he decides to make art instead of money. Mistakes Were Made, now on stage through October 30th. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
You may remember us from such pledge drives as winter 2009.
Or summer 2008. We really enjoyed talking to you.
But we understand that you may not enjoy hearing from us.
That's why for fall 2011, we'd like to suggest you try YStream.
YStream, it's the programming you tune in for without the membership breaks.
You have until October 12th to pledge and take advantage of YStream.
For details, go to whyy.org/YStream.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. The Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson is a National Cancer Institute designated center and is dedicated to providing comprehensive and coordinated multidisciplinary breast care in a compassionate and supportive environment. Breast care services are tailored to fit individual patient needs and are arranged by personal breast care coordinators. To schedule an appointment or for details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And again, our guest is novelist, writer Russell Banks, joining us today on Radio Times. And he does have a new book, a novel called Lost Memory of Skin. It's about a young sex offender living in a shanty town under a causeway. And our guest was telling us then he lives part of the year in Miami and saw such a shanty town under a causeway, rather near his apartment building. And that became the genesis for this story. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You and I were talking during the break about, I think, a pretty horrible show, but nonetheless a very popular show called To Catch a Predator, which is essentially a sting operation where these men come to these houses looking for sex with teenage girls, and they get caught and arrested and hauled off to prison. Was that in part your inspiration?
I can't say inspiration, no, but it was certainly part of the social context that I was exploring in order to write the novel. I watched that show too, and I'm one of those people, who, unfortunately, perhaps, who watches Cops and those other shows, and I always, you know, identify with the perps rather than with,
really?
The cops. Yeah, that's, I think, just an inborn impulse in me or something. Or my sympathies immediately go out to the loser, this guy who's like, so stupid, so clouded, and so befogged psychologically, sexually, and other ways that he can be trapped like that. I was kind of fascinated by it too, because there again, you had that same mix of people as the one I was describing earlier. You know, where some of these people are clearly pedophiles, who are sociopathic and so on, and then others who are just kind of lonely, lost, dumb souls who they're dangerous, certainly. But why are they dangerous is what I was trying to understand and get to. What makes them dangerous, made them into dangerous people? I've written about people who are essentially dangerous in the past. Alcoholic and violent fathers, for instance, or terrorists, for that matter. But always what I've wanted to understand is what made them that way. Why are they violent and alcoholic, or why are they terrorists, in the case of, say, John Brown, the abolitionist, and so forth. And so it isn't a big move for me in a way to be writing about someone like this who's a sex offender and say, okay, why is he? What made him a sex offender? I can get to it on a kid case with a kid. There are other characters in the book where I really could get to. There's a character there named the Shyster, who is a pedophile and an unrepentant one too, and self-justifying one. And that's a type of human being I confess I could not understand. I couldn't get to. And if you can't understand, you can't get to that way, then you can't sympathize with either. But he is nonetheless still, even he, is a human being. And we're treating him instead as if he were dehumanized. We dehumanize him and don't treat him as a human being. I mean, I'm not sure how to treat him, but...
Well, that was my question what are we supposed to do
exactly.
and how are we supposed to respond?
I mean, I'm a novelist, not a district attorney or something, or a legislator. And I think it's my job is really to raise questions and bring realities into our lives that normally we might wish away or avert our gaze from. And after that, I'll join in with the rest of the citizenry and discuss it and see what we can do. But the novel itself is really only designed to raise the questions.
This is a young man, teenager, then young man, who is essentially addicted to sex online. I mean, the kind of pornography that you can find online.
No, it's hard to even avoid.
Well, my other point, which is that it is hard to avoid online. Yeah. And are you saying something about online pornography?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's alienating and depersonalizing. And at one point, finally, the kid, toward the end of it, he starts to have a more critical and skeptical view of it, begins to say it's sort of like paying people so that you can watch animals be abused. Mm. He makes that analogy. And I think that my own thinking kind of drifted along in that same direction. I mean, in the beginning, when I first began the novel, I must say, I didn't really have much of an opinion about it, except a kind of First Amendment opinion, and not much more than
about
that.
Free speech,
yeah,
and people
and so on. And I hadn't thought it through very clearly or very deeply. But over the course of writing the novel, I began to, obviously I had to, start looking at it honestly, more honestly than I had been forced to before and more closely than I had before, and had to come to some sort of conclusion, not just the one which I'd had, which is that it's basically boring and repetitive and exploitative of the viewer. It's also an industry that's exploitative of the very people who participate in it in different ways. And depersonalizing and alienating and de-eroticizing. I've heard many stories since the book has been published, and beginning to hear stories about marriages that have been ruined by the husband becoming addicted to pornography. I mean, his real sex life ended, and the fantasy sex life took over and displaced it.
Would it be fair to say that you did a fair amount of research online?
It would be fair to say. Yeah,
only because if you're going to write about this character,
right,
you have to know what his fantasy world is about.
Exactly, yeah. And there is descriptions of pornographic films and so forth in the novel, not in explicit ways, but summaries. And the kid begins to realize there are only certain kinds of plot structures and so forth, and they can only go so far and do so much, and they do it over and over and over again. And he gets it. But, I had to see the same thing, of course, in order to be able to describe it.
And did you turn against it, or you just found it boring, or?
Well, I began by thinking it was boring and repetitive and formulaic. And I think I ended up, I won't say turning against it, but becoming increasingly aware of its dangers.
Hmm.
We have to, I think, finally agree that we are living in very dangerous times, and we have to find ways to protect ourselves against those dangers. And, of course, skepticism is the first line of defense, I think, for any of us, and a wariness against being commercially, financially, as it were, exploited by our own weaknesses, our own desires, as happens just, when you open a magazine and look at the advertisements. That's what's going on there, too.
I mean, you want that stuff as well.
Yeah, and they walk the line, most ads, by eroticizing the merchandise. They walk the line of pornography, and, it's kind of interesting to see how close they get to it these days.
But you think an argument could also be made, and maybe this is along that First Amendment line, which is that while maybe some of this pornography is ungratifying, that it also shows people what other people do in the privacy of their own homes. You know what I mean?
I'd have a hard time making that case, I think, because I've always felt that that's information that is pretty accessible to most 12-year-olds, and they don't have to go online in order to find it out.
But it's different from Playboy, I would say.
Yeah.
Airbrush Playboy.
But they're not teaching sex. They're basically inducing fantasies. Even Playboy, and that's why the airbrushing.
Yes, part of the fantasy.
Right, exactly.
Russell Banks is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about a number of things, including his new book called Lost Memory of Skin. I'm interested in that title, Lost Memory of Skin, because you say at the very beginning, you quote something from Metamorphosis. The quote is, "Now I am ready to tell how bodies changed into different bodies."
Right.
What are you doing?
Yeah, I think that with the title "Lost Memory of Skin," I'm trying to point toward a number of things, but one of which I've already mentioned, which is the dissolution of that line between fantasy and reality, especially in our erotic lives, through the digitalization of it, in a sense, and also the dissolution really of the connective tissue between human beings that's actual and physical and personal and face-to-face through the internet and that mode of communication, and increasingly so. And so it's pointing to that, that emergence of that gray zone where more and more of our human contact takes place. But it is also pointing to, in a more general way perhaps, the depersonalization, the objectification of the human body. And there is where the other major character kind of comes in a way, and one of the reasons why he's there, and besides the fact that he provides an alternative point of view on the kid's world.
This is the professor.
The professor, who is morbidly obese. He weighs a quarter ton. He's an outside human being, and he's addicted to food. There are a couple of scenes there where he opens his restaurant-sized refrigerator and stands in front of the food that's loaded there like a conductor before his orchestra about to begin a Wagnerian
talk about appetites, right?
Exactly. And the same lights are going off in his brain at that moment as goes off in the kid's brain when he clicks his way toward a porn site. I mean, that anticipation. Or any gambler, the lights that go off in a gambler's brain when he walks into a casino, a compulsive gambler. So the loss of the body through all these various means are started to come into play in the novel. And the professor's version of it, and I think one of the dynamics of the book is how slowly the professor and the kid kind of change places in some way.
Well, I'd actually love to have you read a section from the book where the professor is gazing inside, where it says read.
Okay, yeah, right.
With strong instruction. He's gazing into
that's
his refrigerator.
Right. He heads for the restaurant-sized refrigerator that they purchased the first week of their marriage when they realized they'd be sharing food storage. Pulls open the door and scans the gleaming contents. Dozens of topped-off plastic, paper, and cardboard containers of ready-to-eat food, potato salad, macaroni and cheese, beef stew, lamb stew, curried chicken, fried chicken, pork dumplings, chicken pot pies, half a ham, chunks of cheese, egg salad, tuna salad, sliced meats, marinated tuna steaks, mashed squash, cream spinach, meatloaf, Cuban, Chinese, and Indian takeout, Dominican meat patties and Mexican fajitas, and much, much more, all prepared over the last few days by Gloria, or, as instructed and listed by the professor, purchased at the Watson New York Deli or delivered to the house by the nearby ethnic restaurants, everything ready to be eaten cold or else easily heated in the microwave. In addition, stored for his eventual delectation, there's plenty of backup in the freezer. Loaves of bread, cakes, ice cream, custard pies, pizzas and chicken fingers, french fries, onion rings, waffles, and more. He also has a standing order with his wife to keep at the ready a gallon jug of sweetened iced tea and 2 unopened liters of Diet Coke and a gallon of milk. The professor likes to eat standing up at the kitchen counter, alone, unseen, without his intake being observed, quantified, and judged. And he arranges to do so at least 4 times a week and would do it every night if Gloria did not complain that he should spend more time with his children, since the kids' bedtime is 8:30 and they can only be together as a family when they all sit down to dinner. So 3 and sometimes 4 times a week he manages to arrive home from the university by 6 p.m., where he presides over the evening meal, eating restaurant-sized portions only, nothing excessive, and afterwards conducts a brief interrogation of his children as to the particulars of their schoolwork and extracurricular activities and a television program or two that he personally selects and oversees.
And again, Russell Banks reading from his new novel called Lost Memory of Skin. And I have to say, it takes a lot of guts to create a character that weighs 500 pounds.
Well, there are human beings certainly
no, I know
around
that,
us all over
still.
Who weigh 500 pounds. And lives in his head at the same time, and also in many ways you could see. I mean, those 2 paragraphs there. There's on the one hand his real life is in front of that refrigerator devouring food, but because of that he has also a secret life, you know, where he does it alone, where no one can observe him, and just as every addict seems to do and want to do and need to do. So he's very much addicted, and as much addicted as the kid is.
And is your refrigerator
no, it's nothing
similarly
like that.
Stocked? It's just a little jar of yogurt somewhere?
Yeah, and a couple of cans of beer, and that's about it, yeah.
But you have these characters, the kid, the professor, but later on it's the writer. I mean, these are some generic no-name.
The wife.
Why did you make them...
Well, I was trying to, various reasons. One is maybe the most, the one I can name most easily is that I wanted to take the story and raise it up and approach the level of fable if I could. You know, I didn't want to make this a story that's about Miami, Florida and a very particular kind of social circumstance and so forth. I wanted it to have a more nearly universal or archetypal level of reality. You know, the conventions of realism really are very extensive, and they go from Emile Zola on the one hand and to Gabriel Garcia Marquez on the other. And I think I wanted this to fall somewhere tilted toward the Gabriel Garcia Marquez end, but yet I wanted it rooted in everyday reality at the same time. So by giving the characters... pseudonyms, as it were. I mean, because actually the kid becomes a pseudonym. I mean, pretty soon it's capitalized and you just attach it to that character, and the professor the same, and so on. Everyone else has a pseudonym. I mean, that's true for, you know, it's true in jails, it's true
in
gangs, it's true online, exactly. I mean, the young girl that he tries to contact is Brandy 18, and everybody has a handle, as it were. And so I wanted to kind of have that as operating as well. You know, when I, at a certain point I realized I was writing about a kid who's not quite a child and not quite an adult, who's innocent but not really innocent, and an older man who has moved into a kind of custodial and protective relation to him, who is physically odd at the least, and is also slightly menacing. As we go along, increasingly so. And I realize there's something about this that has got a rhyme or an echo in my mind, a book or a story I knew somewhere. And there was also imagery of treasure maps and buried treasure floating around. It's in the semi-tropical region and all. And I remembered Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. And I went back and read it again. I hadn't read it since I was 11 years old or so. And I thought, oh, yes, this is Jim Hawkins and Long John Silver all over again. And the story is very much similar, at least as I was maybe a third of the way through the book at that point. And I'm unfolding a story in very similar ways. And I said, well, you don't have to invent the wheel here. You know, Stevenson was working with archetypes. And that's a universal story about, you know, a boy or a young man like the kid and an older man like a mentor who's threatening and has to be overcome and displaced in an important way. So in a way, Treasure Island ended up as a kind of ghostly presence in this novel. I mean, which is kind of unlikely, a boy's book, you know, in a book that you probably have to be 16 or 18 years old in order to get permission to read it.
But you didn't know that at the time.
No, I had no idea. I had stumbled into that. Well, I think novelists do this all the time. You know, you stumble, you think you're the first person who ever wrote about this, and then it turns out, no. There's a long tradition. People have been writing, telling this story since before Homer.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And writer-novelist Russell Banks is our guest. He's the author of, I counted them, 19 books, 12 of them novels. Two actually have been made into movies, Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter. There's several movies in the pipeline as well, and the new book is called Lost Memory of Skin, about a young sex offender living in a shantytown under a causeway in Miami. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 23rd at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates can be found online at mfsopportunities.org. mfsopportunities.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll follow up on our recent conversation with high-tech execs who say they can't find qualified employees. Many of our listeners, older laid-off workers, say hogwash. Also, why are the leaves late in turning here in New England? One guess? Yes, climate change. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's Seventh Symphony has endured for almost two centuries. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under Charles Dutoit, performs Beethoven's Seventh, plus the Violin Concerto of Sibelius with Julian Rachlin. For your Beethoven tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorc.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Dutoit conducts Beethoven's Seventh with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with writer Russell Banks about writing and his new book called Lost Memory of Skin, 1-888-477-9499. This gets back to this kid, the young man who has been released from prison after being found guilty of, and he is a sex offender, released from prison, and he has this relationship with this professor. And the professor says this, and I'm wondering whether this is also Russell Banks. He says, when a society commodifies its children by making them into a consumer group, dehumanizing them by converting them into a segment of the economy, and then proceeds to eroticize its products in order to sell them, do the children gradually come to be perceived by the rest of the community and by the children themselves as sexual objects? The idea of in a sense, fetishizing everything. Is that your thinking?
Well, that's the professor's thinking, but and I don't think I would argue too strenuously with it. He's not an unintelligent man, and he's a sociologist, so he's looking at it from that point of view, I think. And that's certainly something I have said in various ways over the years, is that, you know, there has been a kind of objectification of children once you turn them into a consumer group, and they are the largest single consumer group in the consumer economy, which is our dominant economy, that there has been consequences that we haven't really taken the measure of in our society, in our culture. And a lot of it has taken place very slowly over the last half century or so, bit by bit, each generation replaces itself. There's a lost memory of what it was like before children were this huge, huge consumer group, which is a self-replacing consumer group. You know, you sell sneakers to one generation of 11-year-olds. Next year, you've got another generation of 11-year-olds, all new market. And there has been a sense of gradual abandonment of children to the amoral, capitalist, consumer-driven economy, and increasingly so with each new generation, because they themselves were raised that way, and it's normalized. I mean, I'm 71 years old, so it's not. I have a strong memory of the 1940s and 50s, which is really, I think, when we were still unable to think of kids quite that way as a consumer group, and the economy hadn't organized itself around them, and as a result, we as parents hadn't organized ourselves around it either, and the kids themselves hadn't thought of themselves as a consumer group. I mean, I remember the first day of school very, very vividly from the 1940s and so on. And there wasn't this mad shopping extravaganza that took place at the mall that preceded the first day of school, where you had to buy all new clothes and everything else in order to go off. And it wasn't, you know, there were so many what we take as normal, almost rights of social rights, R-I-T-E-S, that we now just think of as must have been here forever. But in fact, they weren't here forever. And I think the professor's kind of pointing in that direction. I mean, he's got his own application, which is to these men living underneath the causeway, and more specifically to the kid, whom he's come to like, and I also hope the reader comes to like, because he recognizes that the kid is basically honest, and that he's a decent human being trying to figure out how to be a good human being who's made a terrible mistake, who knows it, and who has a kind of slightly irreverent sense of humor too, and that he applies despite all. He's still able to crack wise every now and then and get himself a little bit in trouble with it as well.
Well, I'd love to have you read actually a section from the very end of the last little post-it that we have in there, something that we chatted about just before
this
we went on the
air. This kind of puts the kid in a, you know, puts him back in a larger context of all the sex offenders that he is in fact connected to. This is where the kid has made that distinction between shame and guilt, and he's dealing with accepting his guilt. And he's charging up the monitor battery, the battery on his anklet, his GPS anklet. It takes half an hour to fully charge his monitor battery, and during that half hour, the kid feels intimately connected to the millions of other convicted sex offenders, young and old and in between, rapists and child abusers, and men who expose their genitals on a bus, public masturbators, voyeurs and escalator gropers, compulsive seducers of teenage boys, coaches who couldn't keep their hands off their athletes, men who talked dirty in internet chat rooms to people they thought were teenaged girls and then arranged to meet them for sex, fathers and uncles who drunkenly reached out for their teenage daughters as they passed by the sofa, porn addicts and fantasists lost in the misty zone between reality and imagery, no longer able to tell the difference, all of whom at this moment have plugged their electronic shackles into outlets and are sitting in the bedrooms, living rooms, and basements of houses and apartments and mobile homes, in garages, homeless shelters, public parks, in airports and train stations, in waiting rooms, offices, and the back rooms of fast food restaurants and under causeways and overpasses, as if they were all trembling leaves on the branches, large and small, of a vast electrical tree that casts its shadow across the entire country.
And are you also saying that we're connected to these people as well? We may not have a GPS anklet, but nonetheless.
Yeah, we are, and they're human beings, and the kid is a human being, and if he is, then you know, he's connected to them, then they are too. And also that it is a shadow that is cast across the entire country, and it's not something we can make go away or just sweep under the causeway and out of sight and out of mind. It's something we have to deal with, not in a simple, like, punish them or emasculate them in some way or whatever. You know, there's radical solutions that are proposed all the time, or deprive them of constitutional rights for the rest of their lives, but deal with in some more comprehensive fashion. And the novel doesn't exist in order to raise those questions, but it does raise those questions.
Several of your books have been made into movies, Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, and I know a couple are actually in the pipeline, and some that you have written screenplays for.
Right, yeah, I wrote the screenplay adaptation of The Darling, which is being directed by a wonderful French-Canadian director, Denis Villeneuve, whose most recent film was called Encendie, which won a lot of prizes last year at the various festivals. It's an art house, wonderful film, brilliant film. It's going to star Jessica Chastain, who's sort of the actress of the moment right now, wonderful, brilliant actress. And Martin Scorsese is executive producing it, and we're all working together. The four of us to kind of bring this in, and Linda Reisman, who also produced Affliction years ago, she's involved in this as a producer. So that's going ahead this year. I hope, but I wait until the check clears. I really don't.
Of course,
the other one is Rule of the Bone. I'm making that with a wonderful director, Deborah Granick, whose last film was a big prize winner everywhere, and a wonderful, wonderful film about an adolescent and drugs and so forth, among other things, called Winter's Bone. That was hers.
Great movie.
Yes. Before that, she did Down to the Bone. So this is her Bone trilogy, I think.
But do you like, because that must be so different to work on a film compared to being a writer, a novelist, where I'm assuming you're hunkered down somewhere. You and your imagination
That's the first difference is that, you know, writing a novel is such a solitary activity that can go on for years. until you come blinking out of the cave as I am now, you know. Yeah. Into
Is that what
bright
it feels
sunlight.
Like?
It does feel like that. I feel like I've been, you know, in a cave and now I'm out and then sunlight is very bright and I'm blinking and can't quite see. Whereas, you know, filmmaking is, no matter what role you play in it, whether producer, director, writer, et cetera, it's collaborative. It's a team effort. The actors, the
so many moving parts too.
Yeah,
that you
and nobody seems to be in charge.
Is that what you find out?
Yeah, and everybody's struggling.
Not even Martin Scorsese.
Everybody's trying to be in charge, but they can't be. That's the whole point. And then writing an adaptation of a novel is really not a translation or anything of the sort. It's really a kind of a pillaging. You know, you go into the novel and you smash it up into pieces and put all the pieces on the table or on the floor and try to find the pieces in there that will make a good movie. And
yeah.
And they aren't necessarily the pieces that made it a good book. So it's a very different kind of operation entirely.
Is that hard to, in a sense, give up the book you have written to write the screenplay?
I think so. I don't think I could write the screenplay very well of a novel that was not at least 5 years behind me.
Mm-hmm.
If I am 5 years away from a book, then it begins to seem as though it was written by someone other than myself.
And
then I can go into it without much loyalty to it as a novelist, mm-hmm. and I can look and see what would make a good movie here.
I'm curious, as you describe when you're finished writing, you kind of come out into the sunlight, mm-hmm. but this is a pretty big book, complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you live in this sort of
dark
shadowy
world.
Dark world when you're working
yes,
as a writer.
Yes, it is. I must say, I'd like to write a book someday that could be turned into a musical or something, you know, or
something.
Yeah, a happy time show. But I don't seem to be able to get that interested right. enough in material that doesn't have cast these long shadows, And it is true when I'm immersed in a project like this for 3 years or so, which is about how long it took for this book, I live in that world. It's my dominant world in many ways. My wife is also a writer, which helps. She understands that I'm going to be gone for a few years in a sense.
Well, I was wondering about that, what it's like to live with a writer yeah. who's living in another world.
Yeah, and I think she's a poet, so she comes and goes, but more over shorter periods than I do.
Are you irascible? Or are you just not there?
No, I think I'm just adrift in a sense. My attention is not focused very clearly on the day-to-day operations of our life, and that can be, I'm sure, very frustrating to her.
I'm sure. Let me see what David from LaSalle has to say. David, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Yes, I was truly intrigued by what I've heard, and I approach this from two perspectives, a personal one with a relative that has a difficulty that I'm not going to bring up, but also mm-hmm. my professional work, and I'm not going to mention anything that I've done specifically, but what I see going on in our whole society is the complete legitimization, the complete okay for seduction, for creating any desires in other people that we want. That is to say, that's advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That's the market at work.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just say, have you considered, I'm sure, I can just mention that and ask for your comments. I would love to be in contact with you, and I will. And I suppose at this point I could leave it at that.
Well, in fact, David, let's leave it at
yeah.
that, if you don't mind, only because I think you raise an interesting point about living in a society where I guess we feel like we are largely or constantly being seduced.
Yeah.
Are you troubled by that, Russell Banks?
Well, sure, because, yeah, someone's trying to invoke in me a desire that I don't have to begin with and manipulate. It's manipulative, of course, mm-hmm. and it's manipulative for commercial gain for the other person at my expense, ultimately, and manipulating my desires in order to benefit thereby. And sure, and I don't know that, you know, we can forbid that practice, but we sure, I raised four children in the age of television. And so on in the modern era, and now I have two grandchildren being raised by those children, by a couple of those kids, and they all developed very early on, and I think I deliberately cultivated it in them, or encouraged it in them, a great mocking sense of humor, and
that helps.
Yeah, and aggressive skepticism. to armor them, you know, really to strengthen and protect themselves against this constant manipulation of their desires. And, you know, and they're doing it now happily. I can see it. I've just spent some days with my 3-year-old grandson and my daughter and her husband in Los Angeles. They live, you know, in the middle of this world. And he is so skeptical and tough. He finds it all so funny
this is
and
the
ridiculous.
3-year-old?
He's 3 years old. I mean, he's got skills at the, you know, on the iPad and with the remote and so forth that I don't have now. But he's got a healthy skepticism. And that's, I think, the only weapon we can use against it.
Are you working on another book, or is another book working on you? I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet how it works either. I keep waiting to find out after all these years.
After 19 books,
it's
right?
It's still, yeah, every time I go out, I don't really know much what I'm doing until I get there. But I have another book I'd like to write. I'll be coming in off the road at the end of this month and holing up in Miami, and then I will be working again and every day on a book I'd like to write. I'd like to write a very short novel someday, something about 150 pages long.
Have you ever done that?
No. Well, I have, actually, but years and years and years ago. I haven't done it in about 30 years or so. And I noticed that Don DeLillo has just done it. Dennis Johnson just did that. And I think, yeah, I know. I understand the fatigue and that sets in after a long book. You want to write something short.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Russell Banks, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, too.
And Russell Banks has been our guest, and he does have a new book. It's a novel called Lost Memory of Skin. He has about 19 books under his belt, and many of them are novels, and some have been made into movies, and he's, as he was telling us, some are in the pipeline as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can see what Russell Banks looks like. What a thrill. You can also check us out on Twitter and send us an email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.